Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. At the 2025 Burnaby State of the City Address on May 12th, Mayor Mike Hurley announced the formation of a new Mayor's Task Force on Burnaby Economic Growth and Resilience. According to the mayor during his address, quote, Burnaby's strengths as an economic generator and a home for business are many. Whether it's our central location, our extensive transportation network, our amazing amenities, the list of advantages is long. This task force will help us capitalize and build on those strengths. End quote. While the intent behind the task force has been made clear, CJSF decided to reach out to Mayor Mike Hurley for an interview on the topic, to give him the opportunity to name some of the specifics regarding the task force goals and desired impact on the city of Burnaby.
Well, first of all, I've been looking at our economic strategy for quite a while, and it's frankly been a bit outdated. And so I was considering doing something else, but along with the tariffs and everything else we're now facing, I figured it was a great time to get key leaders in our community together to discuss what we can do. And Burnaby's very successful, but what can we do to be even more successful at this time? And to start to chart a path forward, not just right now, but chart a path forward for where we will be going in the future. So,
Mayor Hurley then went on to specify the main focus of the task force.
The task force will be more related because we have done a lot of different task force on affordability and homelessness and housing. We've done those task force and we've charted a pretty good path forward on those. But I think this is strictly economic to look at how we can attract more businesses, how we can ensure that the businesses we have are remaining successful and remaining competitive. And, you know, those are kind of some of the key things. But we need to be very resilient at this time and to be very focused on what we can do and forget about the noise on the outside. It has to be what we can do to be better and to make ourselves more competitive and resilient.
In this response, Mayor Hurley mentions the noise on the outside. We asked him if this noise that he's referring to has anything to do with Canada's current economic relations with the United States.
Well, there's no question that you can't ignore that. That is a fact. But even before this and during COVID and at other times in our history, I think that Canada needs to now learn to stand on its own 2 feet more and rely less on sending some work that we should be doing here overseas to get it done what we feel is cheaper. But I don't believe it's cheaper in the long run. I think there's a big price that gets paid for that. So I think there's tremendous opportunity here if we look at the resources we have in this country. There's no way we should be so reliant on other countries to stay economically viable. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us leaders to work together to make sure that we never put ourselves in this position again.
Later on, we asked Mayor Hurley to explain how this task force on economic resilience and growth in Burnaby will remain accountable to its constituents.
I would hope to have check-ins, come back a year later and see what have we accomplished and to see if we're going in the right direction. So to me, that's a very important piece, is to come back. Are the things we said working? Have we put them into action yet? So, and all of this will be very open-ended to the public. It'll be, you know, under public scrutiny right from the start, and that's a good thing. So, because we want to be as open about everything we're doing as possible. That's how we try to operate in the city in any case.
So far, Mayor Hurley has explained that the main goal of this task force on Burnaby economic growth and resilience will be to create a list of deliverables to be implemented that will increase business investment within the city. We asked if he was able to answer what type of businesses he had in mind.
Well, you know, Burnaby's a big hub for high tech and for, you know, the biosciences. And so we hope to stay there. It's also a big hub for the movie industry. So we'll be very focused on those because those are the big employers. And so employment's very important. So that'll be definitely front and center of what we do here, because part of building that right-sized city and is having enough jobs that people can get to work easily and hopefully even without taking a car. So that's our goal.
Previously, the mayor has created temporary task forces for housing affordability and unhoused population support. We asked if there were any lessons learned from running those task forces that will be noted for this committee.
Lessons learned would be to stay on track, you know, to stay very focused on what we have to do. I think in this case that will be a bit easier because it's not as broad a topic. It's more very focused on economic resiliency. And so I don't think, you know, we'll bring in a moderator to moderate and make sure we're staying on track and staying on the topics that we should be. So that's always the hard part of when you get 12 people in a room, they start going all over the place. So it'll have to remain really focused because 6 months, if you have one meeting a month, that's six meetings, right? So you have to get to work.
Lastly, we asked Mayor Mike Hurley why residents of Burnaby should look forward to this mayoral task force on economic resilience and growth in Burnaby. Why should people care?
Well, I think you should be excited about it because this is the future of our city. You know, it's the future of all our residents that we're dealing with here. If we don't have financial stability, good jobs in our city, that affects everyone. And we all know about the affordability issues as is, so we can't let that get worse. We have to start to improve it. So the excitement should be is, you know, this is charting a way forward for everyone in the city, although it's focused on business. But business are important, very important part of what we do.
Once again, that was our conversation with Burnaby Mayor Mike Hurley on the upcoming mayoral task force on the city's economic growth and resilience. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
So I'm Landon Mossberg. I'm co-founder and CEO of Peak Energy. We're a grid-scale energy storage company that's building batteries based on a new technology called sodium ion. That's really similar to a lithium ion battery. That's the current sort of dominant technology in everything from phones to laptops to cars to grid-scale batteries, which are these big, think of like a shipping container-sized battery, and then you take like literally hundreds of them, you put them in a field on the grid, on the power grid, and then they charge up when energy is cheap and they discharge when energy is expensive. And it lets you basically have less things like peaker plants, which typically are like coal or natural gas. Also lets you build, you know, things like data centers faster without having to wait for long lead time new generation. It pairs really well with renewable energy that sort of you know, it's obviously charging when there's sun, but not at night. And so batteries are really, really helpful to help, you know, build the grid out much faster in a cleaner way, in a more cost-efficient way, in a faster way. And we're doing it on a it's already happening, but it's happening primarily on a technology that was originally developed for laptops, then went to cars. And that's a great technology. Lithium ion is a great technology. I worked on it. My background, I was at Tesla for 5 years back in the early days, from the beginning of Model S until Model 3. And then I left and joined a company called Northvolt back when we were 20 people. And Northvolt's mission was to basically make batteries, lithium ion batteries, but do it in Europe and do it in a more sustainable way. And we worked on that for, I was there for about 5 years, left about 3 years ago. And the company was quite successful in the early days, but unfortunately just so much complexity and challenges and a lot of competition from China, where there's a lot of state support for battery companies. And eventually Northvolt failed. They failed after raising about $16 billion. So it was a pretty big failure. They're the national champion of Europe. And it was a pretty big blow, not only to me personally, but I think to Europe in general and the West in general, and trying to do this in a more sustainable way. So Peak's mission is to do this in the U.S. or in North America, and to do it quickly, but do it in a way that's informed by both the great things we did at Northvolt, and there were a lot of those, but definitely avoiding some of the pitfalls that we saw there as well. And our talk was a lot about that, like, why is this so hard? What are the common failure modes? How are we avoiding those? Why is it important to do it? So that's it was quite good. Really enjoyed it too.
All right, thank you. Next question is, so with the Peak Energy and as a co-founder, what are the core problems that you are trying to solve in the energy landscape, and how does the solution differ from what's already on the market?
Yeah, so our product is a drop-in replacement for similar sort of grid-scale energy storage systems that come from predominantly from China right now. Tesla also makes one. There's a few non-Chinese companies that are in this business, but they're all losing market share and struggling right now because China is able to produce these at very, very low cost. The problem that we're solving is that problem, is the problem of trying to firm up baseload. It's called baseload on the grid. So if you put solar panels out there or any intermittent power generation, which is by far the cheapest new generation in most places in the world now. It's much cheaper than even things like natural gas in North America, when natural gas is really, really cheap. The problem with that is the sun doesn't shine 24 hours a day. And so you need some way to store that energy when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing. Batteries just let you do that. The problem right now, and the way I see this problem, is that batteries are huge part of the solution, if you're going to deploy renewables to the grid, you have this problem with intermittency, and it's the thorn in the side of the industry, of the renewable industry right now. And that thorn is maybe on paper it looks cheap, but it's not actually cheap, because it doesn't, you can't do the entire grid or else people can't use energy at night. And then when you add batteries to the equation, the argument is that makes it too expensive. In reality, China's already doing this at a much lower cost than we are here today. Mm-hmm. So that argument doesn't fully hold up, but I think the standard and the bar we have to hold ourselves when we're trying to transition an entire industry, and the largest industry in the world is the energy industry, the bar we have to hold ourselves to is the highest possible bar. And so we can't just point and say, theoretically, if you look over there in China, they're doing it cheaper, so we should do it here cheaper. Mm-hmm. We have to build a technology that just takes away all excuses. There is no reason not to deploy these, these cleaner, better, cheaper, safer technologies, because they're the best ones, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, even though there is a place you can point to today where that's the case, it's not here, and we can be better. And so let's get there. And so we're building these systems based on this new technology, sodium ion, and it lets you get there. So it really reduces the cost of the system. They're substantially safer. We're going to announce our first product publicly, which we haven't done yet, and that's going to come in a few months, and there's some really exciting innovation in that product that makes these batteries substantially more friendly for communities to be near them. There's been some concerns with other batteries about everything from safety, which I think is certainly a valid concern based on some of the history of the industry. Earlier installations have had trouble with fires. The later ones are substantially safer, so I want to be clear that like LFP batteries are not dangerous if they're being installed in your near your backyard right now. You should feel very, very comfortable with that, but we can be better. So our system is substantially safer. It's also quieter. There's a lot of like nice properties to it, and it's cheaper.
All right, thank you. So with Tesla that you mentioned, Tesla has set a pretty high bar in terms of scaling battery technology and energy systems. How does Peak Energy approach scale differently? And what lessons, positive or cautionary, have you drawn from Tesla's journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think about half of our engineering team on the system side is ex-Tesla engineers. They're like the original guys who, many of the original guys who did the packs, pack designs, a lot of electrical systems and software folks. One of the things I'm most proud of the company is the quality of the team. So we're trying to take all the, like as many good lessons from Tesla as I can. And I'll stay away from like any of the recent political stuff. And like, we're trying not to emulate that. But I think one of the things Tesla did really well was have an aggressive mission that at least when I was there was like laser focused on driving a change to sustainable transport, sustainable energy, all of these things. And we think that batteries are like the unsolved problem. And the other thing Tesla did well is they took smart risks, but they did it with high conviction. And they worked super, super hard because this problem was we felt like it was existential at the time. I still do for humanity in general that we have to solve this problem. So I think, you know, that's about being very engineering focused, being first principle focused. The company is almost entirely engineers. I think we have like there's about 80 people in the company now, probably less than something like 8 of us are non-engineers. Fantastic, like, team of non-engineers, but we're trying to be very, very focused on the technology and on scale and all that stuff and be lean everywhere else and just build the best damn product we possibly can and go as fast as we possibly can because urgency is the name of the game here.
Oh, okay. That's very interesting. Do you think vertical integration as Tesla did is feasible or even necessary for players like Peak?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think there it's really about understanding like how much vertical integration is both like techno-economically feasible and organizationally feasible and optimal, and also kind of I feel deeply convicted that like in a any sort of human interaction, but certainly business is not an exception here, you build relationships with people and partnerships based on trust and mutual respect. And so it's the combination of those two factors, like what is the right business model, and I think you could sort of think about this as like a strategy sort of question. And then, you know, what are the types of people you want to work with and how do you want to be as a partner? And that's more of a cultural question. And so these two things interact when you think about vertical integration. Our approach to vertical integration strategically is that we've seen cautionary tales of where, like, if you're just a systems developer and you only take batteries from a supplier and you sort of integrate them together and you sell a DC block or a battery block to a project developer, you get squeezed in the middle. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good place to stay. So that's why we're pursuing cells. We're also looking at thinking about the wider site as a product. So not just the battery, but also thinking about like how would we integrate the right inverters and stuff and how do we think about like making construction costs lower, and these are all like big levers that are probably in some ways easier now to reduce than the cost of the battery because the battery costs have come so far down. But that all has to interact with the other part, which is really this question of culture. And so you find the right partners to work with, and that and the reason that's important is because like I mentioned inverters, right, and power electronics. There's of course an equation there where you look at like build versus buy, but there's also can I work with a really great partner who I can build a 20-year relationship with and feel high trust and we can both win together? And those two things have to interact. So it's not straight up just an Excel spreadsheet problem. It's also do I have a good partner here and do I want to try to make that partner successful?
And how are you navigating this capital-intensive nature of energy tech while staying agile and innovative?
Yeah, it's really that's a super big challenge. I think there's a general problem in the West of like maybe preference for liquidity versus long-term capital investment, or patient capital is sometimes the way it's described. And, you know, this is something I've been thinking about a lot. So, like, in general, access to long-term patient capital is hard. It's, like, very constrained. And especially if you're talking about large amounts of long-term patient capital that is comfortable with technology risk, that's, like, almost non-existent here. This is one reason that you see China being so dominant. They have capital controls and structures and central driven policies that basically make them better today in their capital markets at funding these types of projects, because like, the capital flows to them regardless of whether private investors want it to. In the US, folks want faster access to liquidity, faster returns. That's not like a culturally driven thing. I think it's actually a product of the fact that a lot of the wealth control in the nation is in the hands of people that have a shorter term investment horizon, typically to be older people, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're a wealthy person in their 70s and you're considering an investment that maybe has a 15-year horizon, maybe that doesn't make any sense to you. But if you're a person who's 25 and you're not going to retire for 30 years, well, yeah, you're okay investing in like a 15-year battery factory or battery technology company that you don't need that money for 30 years, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is the 25-year-old doesn't have very much money. And then in addition to that, we have capital controls or capital sort of regulation in the country that sort of says most of these like longer term sort of illiquid assets are in private markets still. Mm-hmm. So in like public equities, you see much faster, like, shorter term focus on returns and things like that. In the private markets, you see longer time horizons. Now, there's a lot of like nuance here, because in public markets, you also have a lot of disclosure requirements and policy and stuff like that that make it expensive to be a public company. So, and you also don't want to just expose a bunch of private investors, 25-year-olds, also many of them probably don't have the same sort of experience or access to information to take the kind of risks in a private market. So it's a challenging conversation. I'm not saying I have a very good answer to it, but structurally, I think that the challenge is not necessarily that, like, we're really good as a country at investing in technology and taking risks and being dynamic. I think we're some of the best in the world. The problem is this is really, how do we find a better balance in our regulatory frameworks that encourage capital to take longer term risk without exposing people to risks that are unfair or set them up for being exploited. And that's a hard problem. I think there's probably some things with tax policy in terms of like looking at long-term capital gains rates and how and who has access to private equity markets and stuff like that. But I would say at the end of the day, we don't really have an innovation problem and we don't have a risk-taking problem on the operations side. I think this is a capital markets issue. Mm-hmm. That if we really want to fix this long-term without having to have point policies, like in the U.S., you have the IRA, which provides a bunch of like subsidy for businesses like ours, which are very helpful. That's one way to solve the problem, but it's probably not a long-term solution, certainly not a long-term solution, and it's not a structural solution to this problem. I think that's sort of something we need to be thinking about and solving.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, totally. And with the sustainability that you're aiming and with the global push towards a cleaner energy, how do you see the tension between innovation and legacy infrastructure playing out? Can the progress be fast enough?
Yeah, I think this is a really scary thing. Because if you think about energy infrastructure, any of these longer term capital projects, but certainly energy infrastructure, when you put combined cycle gas turbine, which is like currently in the US at least, and I would imagine it might be similar in Canada, it is considered the lowest cost form of generation most places, as long as you have close access to pipelines. And those plants are, even though they generate a lot of climate change challenges, right? And maybe cleaner than a coal plant for sure, but like the pipelines are leaky, it's expensive to do this, you can't do carbon capture very efficiently and all of this stuff, even though many people are saying like, oh, we're going to make these compatible with hydrogen in the future, or compatible with point capture for carbon. Those are certainly technologies we need to be working on. I'm not claiming that we shouldn't invest, but we don't currently have any insight about how those are going to be techno-economically viable. And what worries me is that this the convergence of thing of like onshoring, reshoring of manufacturing in North America, ironically, electrification of transport, which drives more stress into the grid, and data centers especially, are driving urgency into building new generation right now. And that new generation, for political reasons a lot of the time, and for some of the reasons I spoke about before, with like these perceived, this perception that like renewables are too expensive if coupled with batteries, people are choosing to put in new thermal generation, things like gas power plants. And the problem with that, and the really scary thing, is every time you do that, that's a 40-year investment, right? And so one of two things are going to happen. Like the way these are put in too, the investors who do this, they do not do it without having a surety, like a PPA from ratepayers. Those are you and me, like taxpayers or like citizens in the country are obligated. They're going to be on the hook to pay for these assets, mm-hmm. right? The investors are not taking that risk unless there's some sort of law change, which I'm not even sure would be feasible. Mm-hmm. And so that means that those power will face a decision as taxpayers. This is our problem, not the investor's problem, which is still, I think, also a regulatory problem. It should be their problem too. We should make them think about it more. But you put these things on the grid, you're either going to have to keep feeding them gas and polluting the earth for 40 years, mm-hmm. or you're going to have to ask, you know, people, normal people, to pay more in power bills. It's like a tax. Mm-hmm. To shut them down earlier and replace them with renewables. And you actually might, the equation might become so imbalanced that like power, like I think the best case is like solar plus batteries gets so cheap that the equation is so imbalanced that like, okay, even you're just gonna have to shut them down because they're too expensive to run. I think that's the likeliest outcome, because mm-hmm. the other trend, which sort of is again distressing to me, is every year you're seeing massive decreases in the cost of batteries, but also still in the cost of solar and wind, which is crazy. I mean, those things have been dropping like crazy for the last 20 years. Batteries even faster because they're newer technology. Compare that to gas or coal or whatever thermal generation you want. Those things, you're lucky if you get a percent or like half a percent efficiency out of those things per year, right? So the fact that these technologies are already either cheaper or close to competitive on a cost basis with these thermal generation technologies today means that if you fast forward 10 years, 20 years, like it's going to be wildly inefficient. It'd be like thinking about, oh, well, I have a steamship that I'm buying right now. And in 5 years, if I wait, I could either buy an expensive, nuclear aircraft carrier right now, or I could buy a steamship. And just because like that nuclear aircraft carrier is maybe 10% more expensive now, or I could wait 5 years and it's 80, it's like 50% cheaper, I'm still going to buy the steamship because I need it right now. And it's just a crazy thing to me. And I think what's going to end up happening is that like ratepayers are holding the bag, and that batteries help solve that problem, because it also, like, one way you could think about it is it helps us defer new investment in generation. So let's say you don't believe, like, you're not convinced that solar is going to be cheaper. I don't know how you could be, but like, let's say you're not. You don't have to make that decision right now. Put some batteries on the grid. That will shift the power around. You're always going to want to do that, no matter what sort of generation you have. And that lets you defer investment in new generation for a few more years, and you can then decide what you want to do.
Hmm. And are there like any countries or regions you'd highlight as successfully balancing innovation with regulation?
That's a good question. I mean, there's highlights and lowlights, I think, in many different countries' approach to these policies. I actually think, like, polarization in the U.S. Is probably making the environment there not very friendly. One advantage for the U.S. is that you have like the states, the sort of the state system, and there's some sort of laboratories of innovation. Ironically, if you look at the U.S., the places where batteries are being deployed the fastest, there's two states. California is one. The other one is Texas. Mm. And you can't think of like, those are the two bastions. If you think in the U.S., like in the political system, California is like it's the center of the liberal democratic world. Texas is the center of the conservative Republican world, right? And the mm-hmm. fact that these two polar opposites are deploying this technology the fastest signals to me, on one hand, it is the best possible technology for addressing sort of things like climate change, right? And then on the other hand, presumably in libertarian Texas, they're not going to deploy a technology unless it is the best possible technology for techno-economics. And in that world, it's even probably more interesting because there's this sort of general political pushback in the U.S., which I don't understand because these are just things, right? This is an asset that you deploy. There's nothing political about an asset, but like there is pushback that like, you know, solar is bad or wind is bad, batteries are bad, EVs are bad, but like